Hello, everyone. My name is Stephen Downs. My badge says that I'm an artist. I'm not really sure what to make of that. In my real life, I'm more like a scientist. I work for the National Research Council of Canada. I do computer science. I do a little philosophy. And I take a few photographs, so I guess I'm sort of an artist. I kind of like the idea of being an artist. The artist creates fiction and finds truth in that. And it's a bit of a contrast to my day job, where I find truth and create fiction out of that. The theme for this conference, this 2009 edition of Ars Electronica, is human nature. And I'm struck by the audacity of that, as though we have some sort of understanding as to what human nature is. I read an article the other day by Roger Shank saying that humans are inherently dishonest. And I think of all the other writing on human nature that I've read over the years, writing that says humans are inherently social and inherently spiritual, inherently good, inherently bad, inherently this, that, and the other thing. And I wonder, what is the basis for that, how we can have an understanding of what human nature is. Now, we have this idea that's expressed at the beginning of this conference of the body politic, the idea that we collectively make a single entity, and I'm reminded of Hobbes's Leviathan. But in the body politic, people were given very specific roles to play. The king was the brain, and people like me were, well, fingers and toes. We have an understanding, intuitively, of what human nature is, but more and more, as we learn more about what humans are, our understanding is being shown to be false, or at the very least misleading. People like Stephen Stitch and Paul Churchland write about folk psychology as the psychology or understanding of human nature that people have based on fictions like beliefs and hopes and dreams and desires, and they look instead to an understanding of humans and human nature based on the actual material that we are made up of. The idea of humans as a neural network, the idea of thought, beliefs, etc., being reduced to or understood of in terms of the interactions between neurons in this network. And here we are beginning to come up with some sort of understanding of ourselves, some sort of understanding of ourselves as an embodied mind, some sort of understanding of ourselves as a person created out of a network of synaptic structures. And so when we look at the idea of the global brain, as was brought up in the introduction to this session, we look at the idea not of the global brain as a single consciousness, as a single Leviathan, but as billions of neurons forming connections with each other, achieving consciousness in that way. But what does that look like? We think together, but we remain independent in our identity. And in this independence, somehow, we are told, we produce one sort of single consciousness, a collaboration, a unity of thought, a unity of spirit, a unity of ideas. We have, we are told, a worldwide social network of self-selecting people resembling a human brain that will collaborate together in order to solve the world's problems. But what does this collaboration look like? What does this model that we were given even in the introduction to this session look like? Well, we find that collaboration depends a great deal on sharing. Schrag talks about an act of shared creation or shared discovery, and Peter Senge talks about the creation of a shared vision in the corporate environment or in the corporate context. We have this idea of collaboration as a sense of sameness of purpose, sameness of objective, sameness of goals. And we're going to hear, and we do hear over and over when people talk about a global consciousness, of having the same sort of outcome in mind, each and every one of us, seeking that ideal end state of some sort. We have an idea of collaboration as a common understanding of the world. This ranges from Vygotsky's zone of proximal development to the idea that there can be underlying archetypes, as described by Jung, or even just the general statement that learning, knowledge, understanding, or language are all inherently social in nature, that meaning is inherently social in nature. We have, in this idea of collaboration, the idea of working together, working each one of us individually as part of the single whole, where changes propagate one to the other, very quickly and very easily. Look how quickly we can affect 1 billion lives on the internet, where coordination is tight, where everybody moves as one. But what I would ask is, do neurons work that way? Because if we are going to use the brain as we currently understand it, as the model of collaborative action, as the model of collective action, then we ought, shouldn't we, to examine just exactly what that brain looks like, rather than relying on some sort of folk psychological idea of what beliefs, what actions, and what community is like. Well, let's examine the neural system, and I'll ask, first of all, right off the bat, is there a head neuron, a big chief, the neuron that tells all the other neurons what to do? Is there the neuron that is the celebrity, the neuron that all the other neurons look up to? And of course, there is no such neuron. Is there a neuron in our mind that is client-focused? Does the concept of client focus or sense of purpose or any of these things even make sense to a neuron? You see, the picture of collaboration that we've been given to this point implies some sort of sameness, a sameness where meaning is created out of the sameness of each and every entity in the network, where each and every entity has the same purpose, the same vision, the same goal. It's a unity that looks like a rock or an ingot of metal or something inert, where the meaning is created by the identity rather than the distinctiveness of each component part. It's a meaning that is based on what might be called semantic consistency. The idea that there is some sentence that each one of us thinks is true, some belief that each one of us has. The semantic similarity, the semantic identity, is what creates collaboration, is what is necessary for collaboration as expressed in these traditional terms. But the idea here is that truth, meaning, communication, all of these things are in the entity itself. That truth is in the knower. That meaning is in the sentence, in the word. That communication occurs in the transmission of information. But this is actually the opposite of what happens. If we look at neurons, truth, meaning, communication are not at all in the neuron itself. Rather, what we see strikingly from a semantical perspective in a neural net is diversity. Each neuron decides what to do on its own. Each neuron has its own unique set of inputs, its own unique set of outputs. The semantic state, if we could even call it that, of any given neuron, will be completely unique to that neuron. The neuron's perception of the world, which is to say its set of connections with other neurons, is unique to that neuron, and in fact, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if one neuron means one thing and another neuron means another thing. It simply doesn't matter. This is characteristic of communication in English language as well, or in other languages, I shouldn't just say English, I suppose, contrary, again, to our folk psychological understanding of conversation, of communication, and of meaning. We have this sense that if we say Paris is the capital of France, everybody means exactly the same thing. But everybody's experiences, everybody's connections to Paris are different. Each person means something different when they say Paris is the capital of France. What's important in communication is not sameness of meaning, it's not sameness of truth or even sameness of worldview. Rather, it is syntactic consistency. That is to say, the physical structures rather than the semantical structures of the entities communicating need to be consistent, need to be capable of interacting with each other. And in this way, we get what Wittgenstein called our language games, where the meaning for one person and the meaning for another person might be very different, but communication happens as a process of negotiation back and forth, between people attempting to communicate with each other. Each person has their own idea, their own understanding of the world, but the communication is made possible by their interaction with each other through these syntactic structures. The sharing by entities of this common system of communication or of infrastructure is what may be called the interaction thesis of communication, the interaction thesis of community. Community is created on this model not by sameness of vision, not by sameness of purpose, not by sameness of meaning, but rather it is defined by the interactions and the connections among those entities. The clustering phenomenon that we might find in a network or in a neural network. What happens is, rather than all becoming the same to form a community, each of us instead retains our individuality. And so we don't try to believe the same thing, have the same purpose, have the same goal, but rather we each maintain our own purpose and objectives and goals and cooperate through interaction in a common network, in a common infrastructure, in the same way that neurons acting independently cooperate with each other by sending signals back and forth in the same network. And thus, what we have here is the concept of neural cooperation. Neurons connect to each other syntactically. They send electrical signals, which result in biochemical processes. These processes inherently have no meaning. It wouldn't make sense to say these processes have meaning. The meaning is created through these interactions and not as a part of them. Community is created in this way. Community is not collaboration, but rather is cooperation. If you look at a city, look at the makeup of a city, what are we really seeing when we see a city? Not a whole bunch of people directed toward one goal, but rather each person trying to make his or her own way in life, as John Stuart Mill would say, to pursue his or her own good in his or her own way. The study then of collaboration, quote unquote, the study of collective intelligence, therefore, is the study of the mechanisms of cooperation and the mechanisms by which these cooperative mechanisms can be used to preserve truth, to preserve meaning, to achieve desirable outcomes. These mechanisms are associative mechanisms, and there are a variety of these mechanisms. The first of these is association by similarity, where things tend to become connected to each other if they are similar to each other. And this is a mechanism described by Donald Hebb. Hebb was describing the way neurons connect with each other, but similarity is also a mechanism by which humans connect with each other. We look at clustering on the internet, and we see people with similar interests propagating around certain sites, people with similar views sending messages to each other. But that's just one mechanism of association. Another mechanism is proximity, being in roughly the same place at the same time. We see this in the eyes, where neural cells are related to each other by proximity. David Hume, talking about principles of association, talked about the principle of contiguity. One event follows another very close in time, which gives us the associative principle we call today cause and effect. Another principle is feedback, or as Rummelhart and McClellan would say in parallel distributed processing, back propagation. This is the idea of learning from our experiences. This is the idea of the network of connections between individual entities, whether they be people or whether they be neurons, being affected by events external to the system. And then finally, we have a mechanism that may be characterized as harmony, or the Boltzmann mechanism. This is the idea of a network tending to achieve the most stable possible state. The best way to visualize this in your own mind is the way a surface of water settles into a flat state after being disrupted by a stone. But the most stable state might not simply be a horizontal surface. Gaudi, in his architecture, looked at stable states in architecture. And one of the displays across the road there looks at stable states in, I'm not sure what they were, filaments. Together, what these create is a society, but not a society that actually exists today, because today we exist in a society of managers and prime ministers and stars and celebrities. Rather, it's a society that is made up of a large number of syntactically interacting entities, each with its own purpose, each attempting to do its own thing. And the property of any individual of those entities is not the property of the whole. What I mean by that is the following. We have this idea of this, well, Kevin Telly calls it the new socialism, but we might even say the new mind, the new collaborative state, the new global consciousness. And it tends to be defined by the contents of our ideas, by the contents of our collections, by things like Wikipedia, where we all come together to create the same encyclopedia. But if the content of our global consciousness is based on the content of an individual mind, then the whole cannot be more than the part. For the content to be greater than the part, the content must be more, over and above, that which is contained in any individual mind. Imagine if a brain depended on individual neurons for meaning. The brain could then attain no more intelligence than a single neuron. Rather, what we have is a model, a form of socialism, which is described as a form of personal empowerment, not propagation of some idea, but rather maximizing the potential of each individual entity in the network. Personal empowerment, equality of opportunity, sociality, and independence. These four together constitute a semantic condition. They constitute a description of a successfully functioning network, one which will achieve a stable state but not a stagnant state. The first of these four principles is autonomy, the idea that each neuron or each person in society acts and functions according to its own internal needs, its own internal drives, goals, values, understanding of the world, meaning, and truth. The second principle is equality of opportunity, or another way of putting it is openness. The capacity for each neuron, each entity, to actually connect to the network as a whole and to contribute to the network as a whole. Old-style broadcasting and television were not open in this way. You had to be a television producer or a movie star in order to have a voice on the movies or on television. The internet is much more open, although not completely open, obviously. And each individual connected to the internet has at least that capacity to have a voice, to connect to the network. The third principle is diversity. It's the flip side of autonomy. The idea here is that not only is diversity tolerated, but rather diversity is expected and indeed celebrated. We don't try to have, all of us, the same idea. We understand that a global consciousness occurs only when each of us has a different idea, a different perspective. It's the old parable of the elephant, right? We can only understand the concept of the elephant if each of us has our own individual perspective on what the elephant is, rather than trying to come to some single shared understanding of what the elephant is. And then finally, the fourth principle, the fourth semantic principle, is interdependence. The idea that we are connected, that we interact, and that meaning, truth, knowledge, etc., constitute emergent properties of the network. They are not properties in the communications, they are not properties in the individual nodes, in the individual neurons, but they're something that can only be recognized from outside the network. And so this taken together brings us toward a thesis of what Ivan Illich called conviviality, the appropriate and congenial alternatives to social organization than the tools of domination, the tools of mass media, the tools of star power management and control that we have today. In order to make this system work, we communicate with each other. We communicate not just with words, but with each act, with each entity, with each artifact that we create. My words are a word. A photograph is a word. A multimedia presentation is a word. This presentation is a word. Each one of these artifacts becomes a word in that complex conversation, a conversation that goes well beyond the meaning that we might find in any individual act or in any individual artifact. And that's my presentation, and this is me, the artist.